as you work through it with me over the next little bit of time together. I wonder if you've heard the phrase, they would have followed him anywhere. It's the kind of phrase you come across commonly as a history teacher. I find them in obituaries of soldiers, these ultra-brave people whose men would have followed them anywhere. And I found one from not so long ago, 2009. The commander described this officer as a natural leader, tactically astute, clear-sighted, and cool and decisive under pressure. His platoon gave him the nickname 007. They would have followed him anywhere. A real-life hero, right? And I wonder how often you feel like you need one. How often some situation, as they do, right, just lands on you. Maybe through a phone call or an email or a message or a conversation with someone, or you see something happen, a situation just lands, and you don't know what to do, and you need a hero. It's a really human emotion, isn't it? To feel that, oh, I need help. I come across it quite often at work, actually, and one of my bosses, she knows when I'm having these moments. And if a crisis arises, I send her a little help email. It's kind of like sending up a mountain flare. And she reads the emails, and they're my favorite responses I ever get. Four words. I kind of pour out my arms. I'm scared. I don't know what I'm going to do about this situation. Four words she writes back. Leave it with me. Oh. And you think, ah, my hero. She's just saved me from whatever this is. And I think there's so often times that we need that. The Israelites needed that. In our passage today, we'll see that. They have this sense of, we need a hero. We need our king to arrive. And I think they had in mind, if we put up on the screen, I have got a clicker here somewhere so I can click along as well. But the three things we'll work through is the hero we want, the hero we get, and the hero we need. And I think what you see in this passage is that the Israelites were really clear on the hero that they wanted. Really clear on it. It's actually a major theme running through the Old Testament, that they were waiting for their hero king to arrive. They'd had a great king in David, really good king. And after that, a succession of mostly pretty rubbish ones. Disappointment after disappointment, people who'd led them to disaster in a range of ways. And they were just waiting for their hero king, the real deal, to arrive, their Messiah. And by the time we get to John's gospel, that's even more acute. They are waiting under the thumb of Roman oppression. They're occupied by the powerful military empire of Rome, and they are just waiting for their hero king to stride in and save the day. And we're nearly at the day, actually. If you look at this scene as it's set for the first three words in our passage, just look down at them. Those three words, the next day, tell us that there's an important context here. And there's a couple of things that have just happened in the day before and the recent days, which set the scene up for something special. Jesus has just come from some serious hero king action. So he's raised Lazarus from the dead. It's pretty heroic, pretty amazing. He has just been anointed the day before with a kind of a bucket full of perfume by Mary. A sign that she, for one, would follow him anywhere, and a hint to us, too, that he's reaching the apex of his mission rescue. Then you could go to Jerusalem itself, which is where we are, right, at the start of this passage, and the expectations building there, too. There's a sense of hype like no other. Everyone's heading to the city because it is it's the build-up to the Passover festival, and there's a lot of people there. Yeah, I just wanted to give you a bit of perspective on this. If we have it on the screen, this is, that's my fault. There we go. No, it's not. There it is. Right, this is aerial footage of the second referendum march in 2019. Just to give you a scale of the numbers, can you see the people, tiny little dots in the streets as the drone flies over, street after street after street, crammed with people? They reckon the number of people at that march is about 1 million. I don't know how they count that. But they reckon it's about 1 million people there. Now, if you take that 1 million people, they're crammed into the streets of London, cram them instead into the streets of little Jerusalem, okay, 2,000 years ago, and then, according to some kind of historical estimates, add maybe another 1 million, some estimates suggest. Certainly, it's a lot of people you're beginning to sense the kind of tinderbox atmosphere that Jesus is striding into. This place is primed. And then if you look at the end of chapter 11, you can see some of those expectations. Just flick back to verse 55 of chapter 11. It's almost time for the Jewish Passover. Many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all? Where is he? Where is he?" Then look at verses 12 and 13. They go out to meet him with palm branches. You've got this massive buzz of excitement, and then you have the crowds flocking to the streets, and they go out to greet Jesus with palm branches. What's in their minds? Well, you can hear it loud and clear. Look at their cry in verse 13, "Hosanna." It means give salvation now. Rescue us. Save us. It's here. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's drawn from Psalm 118. And it indicates they thought this was him. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And in case there's any doubt, they go on chanting, "Blessed is the King of Israel." And they're chanting this out in a Roman-occupied city. Okay, these people are at boiling point. Their expectations are through the roof, and they think he's here. Look at the final clue. Probably the biggest one is the palm branches. This is a weird one because we think of this as Palm Sunday, right? Not today, but in the church calendar year, we think of Palm Sunday. And it's not traditionally, the palm symbol was not traditionally at the Passover, right? That's something that we now reflect on after this bit in the passage. But they didn't usually use palms on this day. They used them in the Feast of the Tabernacles, so I read. A few months earlier in the kind of the calendar year, but they did not use them at the Passover. So why now? And the reason is this: that symbol, the palm, had become a symbol of kind of national uprising. A guy called Simon the Maccabee drives out the Syrian forces about 140 years earlier from Jerusalem. There are palm branches being waved as a symbol of that. The palm symbol appears on coins struck by rebels rising up against the Romans later on. And here, Jesus strides into Jerusalem, and it's those palms again, right? The symbol is there. So you've got these two things. You've got this frustration and waiting and a need for a rescue, and then you have a city crammed full of people who clearly think this could be it. The rescuer could be here. The picture of the hero they want is on their lips. It's on their, you know, they're waving palm branches. The symbol's there. It's really, really clear. That's the hero they want. And then there's the hero that they get. Now, I don't know if you've ever been caught waiting for rescue. You ever seen a sign a bit like that? If you have, then you've been on the hard shoulder somewhere waiting for rescue. And in my mind, because, you know, you're trapped on the hard shoulder, your vehicle's broken down, and you're waiting for rescue. In my mind, that symbol would be more exciting if it was that, wouldn't it? Rescue by, or maybe rocket ship. When's my rocket coming? Or even just that, a Superman. That's what I want. And what do you get on that sign? You can picture it, can't you? You get the trundle bus. And it just, have you ever seen a really bad one? And they come along and you think, oh my goodness, who's towing who here? That's my rescue vehicle. It's arrived and I'm a little bit disappointed. I think something just a little bit like that is happening here. Okay, I think if there had been a sign similar to this one for their expectations, it would have looked like that, or perhaps a little bit like that. A hero on a war horse, right, striding into Jerusalem, brave and bold, flying the flag, waving the palms maybe, on a massive, frightening war horse, ready to come and stick it to the Romans. Okay, and then what do they get? Verse 14, they get that. Jesus found a young donkey and sat upon it. What a letdown for people expecting this warrior king to arrive. You can hear the air leaking out of their balloon of excitement, can't you? I had an experience this week, very similar, right, in a very small way, in that I was due for my camping holiday. I was very excited about this. I was going to have a nice little breakaway. And my dad has got one of these fancy pump-up tents. Do you know the ones where the poles are made of, well, they're made of plastic, but they're filled with air? And that was the scene I had in my head. That was where I was going. I was going to have a lovely, lovely camping time. And that was the scene at the start. That is this week. I took a picture to show how beautiful it was. You know, and you talk a show off about it. Here's my holiday. And then I went out for the day. And when I got back, that was my tent. The air had leaked out. And it's as if God was preparing me for a sermon illustration. Thank you. And that's where I slept. That's my car. So I had a lovely night in the back of the car on a camping mattress. A little bit of a letdown in a number of ways. Maybe this picture is more helpful, though. You know the ring walk, the boxer ring walk? Here are some famous ones. This is Anthony Joshua on a pedestal with pyrotechnics going up around him. There's Tyson Fury there. Literally, he's got a throne. He does the big walk into the stadium. The fans are going crazy, and he sits down on a throne because the fans want their man to look as big and bold and brave and tough as they possibly can. Imagine if you had a stadium full of them chanting, waiting for their man to arrive, and they got that. I think someone should try that, but it's not the image they want, right? That would be disappointing. This is our brave hero. This is our big boxer. Something like that's going on here when Jesus, expected on a war horse by some, comes into Jerusalem on a donkey. From the outside, it doesn't look glorious at all. It doesn't look exciting. It doesn't look heroic. It looks humiliating. Okay, it looks like a letdown. What's he going to do? Take on the Romans on a donkey? But thankfully, we're not the only ones who struggle to understand. You see the disciples in verse 16? At first, his disciples did not understand all this, and certainly many in the crowds wouldn't have done. So if you've ever had your expectations dashed by the way Jesus appears to you sometimes, you won't be alone. These people did too. But the truth we need to leave here this morning with is that he may not be the hero we think we want. The hero we get might disappoint us at first if we look at it superficially, but he is the hero that we need. He really, really is the hero that we need. And we can see that in this passage really clearly. Okay, he's declaring loud and clear that I am that king. I am that hero that you need. This is the rescue. And this is the fascinating, powerful part of this entrance into Jerusalem. My rescue, he says, is not smaller and weaker, it is bigger and better. And it might not look it at first, but dig deep with me and you will see. Let's dig deep now. Look at the clues. So you've got the choice of the donkey, right? He's not on a donkey because rentmywarhorse.com is out of stock, right? It's no accident. Oh no, what's left? Right? This is a deliberate choice because it links to Zechariah 9. Right? Look at verse 15. It's a quote from Zechariah 9, "See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." And many of them would have known some of the rest. You can see it there. And the rest of that, part of the rest of that passage in Zechariah, it says, "I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." So he's choosing a donkey to say, I'm not just going to be a warmonger. In fact, I'm going to end all war. I'm going to bring peace. And I'm not just going to bring it to Israel. I'm going to bring it to the whole world. But that might leave us with a question, especially if you're new to Christian things. You might want to ask, so what is the plan? Because he has arrived on a donkey. What is it, a ninja donkey? Has it got secret equipment? Has it got some blasters that he's going to use? Well, the hint comes from the crowd themselves. Do you know they almost tell us, but they just miss it. Look, where they start shouting Psalm 118, verse 26, they shout, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." They narrowly miss declaring what comes a few verses earlier. Just up there, verse 22 and 23, "The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes." The stone that the builders rejected. The end of chapter 11, we see the plan born in the Sanhedrin and that meeting of the Jewish leaders, the plan that Jesus must die, must be executed. They're planning the end of Jesus because they feel so threatened by him. One commentator summarizes it like this. He writes, "The glory of Palm Sunday is not that the long-awaited king parades into town amid the pomp and flare of natural human expectation. No, here is a Nazarene, a backwater, purported to have been conceived in shame, a laborer by trade, riding not on a noble steed, but the colt of an ass. He comes not to brandish his sword and demonstrate his quality for the popular expectations. He comes instead to give his own neck to the knife and display his meekness in uncompromised sacrifice. He comes not to kill, but to be killed." And so they have in their minds this disappointment, don't they? The sign might come back up in a second. They see, and they want to see that. Okay, that's what they're expecting. And then they see that, and they're disappointed. But what they're missing at that stage, they couldn't quite have known, could they? But we can. What they're missing is that. That's the rescue. See, Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, which looks like a humiliation, that's just the start of the humiliation that week. It's only the beginning. He's going to fall to greater depths still when he dies a criminal's death on a cross within days. The humiliation's not over. But he really, really is the hero that we need. He's not a failed rebel. And I wonder how many of the crowd went home that day, having chanted out a part of Zechariah 9 and seen that donkey, with a little bit of disappointment, but just those verses niggling in the back of their minds. I wonder if they remembered, it should come up for you, I wonder if they remembered some of these others. I'll read them to you, they're a little bit small. Verse 11, "As for you," this is in Zechariah 9, "as for you, because the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. Return to your fortress, you prisoners of hope. Even now, I announce that I will restore twice as much to you. The Lord will appear. The Lord will appear over them. His arrow will flash like lightning. The sovereign Lord will sound the trumpet. He will march in the storms of the south, and the Lord Almighty will shield them." I wonder how many had that. Just like there's more to these verses. I wonder if how many of them went home and started thinking about that last part. From Zechariah 9, "The Lord their God will save his people on that day. And as a shepherd saves his flock, they will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown." See, the entrance, the ring walk, might have dampened expectations. Might have been a letdown to those waiting for their hero to come. And many might have gone home thinking, still waiting, still sat here on the hard shoulder of history. Not yet rescued, not yet saved. The hero I wanted doesn't seem to be the hero that I actually got. And I wonder if you ever have a little bit of a feeling like that about Jesus. That for all the hype and all the hope that he seems to offer, I wonder if there's just a small part of you that sometimes wishes He'd save you from the situation that you're in right now. Maybe day to day, he'd do just that little bit more. Maybe day to day, he'd just be a little less donkey and a bit more war horse. The hero that you want to stride through the door and rescue you, and the person you want to say, "Leave it with me." I wonder if you ever have that feeling of, "I wish there was a bit more of that." And I think, you know, we'll all have different daily oppressions, different challenges, different battles. For the Israelites, amongst their smaller daily battles, I'm sure, like us, but they have this big deal, right? The Romans, that occupying force, and they were waiting and waiting for their hero to come. Now, unless I've missed something in the history, you won't be waiting for rescue from the Romans, but there will be something for you. Maybe it's work, family, physical health, mental health, money, school, college, friendships, There'll be somewhere you want your hero to stride in and rescue you. And the thing we need to avoid is making the mistake that some in the crowds made that day. We need to avoid the mistake of thinking that Jesus is somehow just a little bit of a letdown when it comes to the rescue. Remember, when he arrived on the donkey, although some were disappointed, he did not deliver a smaller, weaker rescue, but a bigger, better one. Right? It was bigger and bolder and better, and he was going to reign from sea to sea, not just Israel. This was a bolder rescue. Some of you will still have in your minds, though, the question of, how can that be when there are still wars on the news, prisoners, problems of all kind? There are still 1,000 small oppressions and occupations in our lives which don't seem to have been fixed by our hero. And I think the thing to have in our head is the thing they needed in their head that day, which is this: Jesus does not always solve that short-term problem. He didn't arrive that day to kick out the Romans. That's not what happened. It's not why he was there. He might not save your job. He might not heal your illness. He might not fix that relationship which has gone bad. He might not do it. He might. Jesus delivers all kinds of goodness to it, but he might not. But then again, why, when he strode into Jerusalem that Sunday, would he choose to save a temple and a city which he knows will crumble to dust anyway, when instead he can solve the problem at the bottom of all problems with a solution that will last forever? Why ride in on a war horse and deliver a short-term, temporary nationalist victory which might have satisfied the people then and there? Why do that when instead you can deliver an eternal overthrow of the great enemy of sin? Human sin that causes all those other oppressions, that causes those wars and imprisonments and every daily battle you face. His death on the cross was a once and for all cure of the sin that causes all of those things. And his resurrection, the guarantee that he's won. And so maybe there's two kind of applications here as we come to the end. If you aren't a Christian, if you are someone who's looking in from the outside and seeing this donkey-riding king, I urge you to ask yourself the question, might he actually be the hero that you need rather than the one that you want? Is that problem, the problem of the sin of the human heart, your problem too, the one that causes us to turn away from God, the one who made us? Is that maybe your problem too? And if so, the rescue is here for you too. He arrived on that donkey to declare war on the problem which you have, and I do. If you're not following Jesus, how will you respond? If you look down just very quickly as we come to the end, you can see a range of little responses here. The crowd in verse 18, they want to know more. They drift towards him. Some for the right reasons, some for the wrong ones, but they're there. And they look at him, they study him, they want to see a little bit more. I urge you to have a think about that option. Come closer. Look at him. Read about him. Talk to Christians about him. He might just compel you with his rescue. What about the Pharisees in verse 19? They continue to reject him. That's an option too. But for what gain and at what cost? If you are a Christian here today, you, like me, need to remember that in every situation, in every one of 1,000 different oppressions, big and small, he is exactly the hero you need, even if, like me, you sometimes get your expectations misaligned. We can be like the crowd in verse 17, right? Continue to spread the word. And what will we say when we spread the word? Amongst other things, we can say to others what we say to ourselves day by day. We can preach to ourselves that in every situation, Jesus is exactly the hero you need. He is the hero riding to the rescue for every problem, big and small. because his promises are so sure. The hope he gives is so concrete. So maybe the next time your Romans crowd in on you, you can repeat to yourself, with the guarantee of the cross in your pocket, the words of Zechariah 9, verse 16. I love these. The Lord their God will save his people on that day. As a shepherd saves his flock, they will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown. Let's pray.